The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back. I'm Bob McChesney, your Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 here in Urbana, Illinois. It's April 20th, Easter Sunday. We're live in the studio, and we're going to be talking, as usual, media and politics. Today, we're very fortunate to have as our guest calling, speaking with us from her home in Madison, Wisconsin, Ruth Conniff. Ruth Conniff is the political editor of the Progressive magazine. She writes widely in national politics and also serves as the voice of the Progressive on many television and radio programs. She's been a regular guest on CNN, C-SPAN, PBS, NPR, and Pacifica. Her op-eds have appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times. Ruth Conniff, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really a delight to have you, Ruth, and I've been trying to get you on the air for a long time, and I'm glad we've finally been able to get a time to do it, especially on Easter, which is very kind of you to take time away from your family.
Not a problem.
Well, let's start with the pressing story of our recent times, which is the war in Iraq, and the way it's played out politically in the United States. What's your sense of, have you been surprised by the way the war proceeded and the support for the war and the way the press coverage has gone, or is it pretty much gone as you thought it would?
Well, I think the press coverage, it was pretty clear from the beginning, was a triumph for the Pentagon, and it was, you know, early on when they decided to embed these reporters with the troops, it was pretty clear that they had perfected a PR strategy that I actually heard people at the Pentagon crowing about back in the wake of the Gulf War, which was to sort of develop a PR machine and an ability to relate well with the media rather than stonewalling and making enemies with reporters, that has served them very, very well. And, you know, the various military branches offer junkets to reporters. They send out local reporters from areas where certain military equipment is being made on, you know, the Seawolf submarine. Or, you know, they've managed to get sort of puff coverage of military contracts and military issues that affect local communities. And I think that they have sort of developed a more and more sophisticated way of spinning the media while providing sort of the access that reporters crave. And that's, you know, it's in a way, it's an ironic problem. During the Gulf War, they herded reporters into these pools and kept them far from the action. And there was a lot of griping about the inaccuracy of reports that came out of that and the fact that, basically what you got was a spoon-fed coverage. All that the reporters really had to go on, for the most part, except for a few brave loners, was the, you know, press releases that were daily issued to them in the pool room, far from the action. Now that they've come up with this new strategy of embedding reporters, what we have instead is reporters who are actually on the scene, and they're able to see a lot more action. But it turns out to be, a source of stories that praise, you know, the valor of the troops, reporters who are incredibly grateful for the physical protection offered to them by the troops that they're embedded with, and who really offer the perspective of, on the ground, the aggressor force, and not the population that's affected by the war. They're not, you know, cowering in homes with Iraqi citizens as the bombing is going on. They're with the troops in trenches who are, you know, and they have adopted, I think, largely the perspective of those troops. So I think the media coverage from the very beginning of this war has sort of been mixed together with the military perspective. It's been, you know, almost of a piece. And then add to that the sort of overwhelming message from Washington, and that's repeated in the media, of the idea that we need to support the troops, and that the time for a critical assessment of this war was passed as soon as the war began. I think there's tremendous nervousness, particularly from a media that's terrified of being called liberal and that is hounded by right-wing groups that constantly accuse it of having a liberal bias. There's a real fear of appearing too critical. So basically, I think the media coverage was almost overwhelmingly, in the U.S. media and particularly the television media, a big win for Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, Ruth Conniff, what sort of stories do you think have been missing that should have been out there and gotten more attention, or right now should be out there? Actually, there might be a better way to put it. What would a healthy journalism be talking about now in our news media, the U.S. news media, especially U.S. television news media, that is largely absent in your view right now?
Well, I mean, I think the first and most obvious thing is the difference between the U.S. TV coverage of the war and the coverage in Europe and certainly in the Arab world, which is, you know, that the it's almost as if this war were conducted without anybody dying, as far as the U.S., especially the television coverage, is concerned. It looks like a video game. And we don't have a sense of what the real costs of war are, the civilian casualties. And that's something that is very much on the minds of people in the Arab world, certainly the people who are closest to the bombing and the death that's going on in Iraq. So I think that's one thing, is that we don't have a good enough view of, you know, what war really means, what the costs really are, and it allows us to have this very padded, remote perspective in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of sports terminology bandied around and talking about the war, and there's just a real sense of remoteness from how violent and chaotic and ugly war really is. So I think that's the biggest sort of global thing. And then, you know, there's been very, very paltry coverage of dissent. There's been sort of sneering coverage
Of domestic dissent, you mean, Ruth?
Domestic dissent and the international anti-war movement. And there's a piece in the Sunday New York Times today, which is sort of a typical sneering piece about the anti-war movement, saying that it's sort of struggling to find its message now that the war is over. And the implication is sort of that there's nothing meaningful to say that, you know, the events have overtaken any critique of what's happening. But, of course, you know, what's happening in our country is this massive shift in a foreign policy of preemptive warfare, really, you know, kind of a lawlessness, a flouting of international consensus and international law. And I think there needs to be a really hard look at what the repercussions of that are for Americans, for other countries, what the sense of the U.S. role is abroad, how we're perceived, and how this war is experienced by people, you know, the civilians in Iraq, people who are directly affected. I think, you know, there's a kind of myopia in the United States and a kind of failure to grasp how we're perceived abroad, and it's not really helped by media coverage that doesn't bring us that view.
We're talking to Ruth Conniff today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Ruth is the political editor for The Progressive magazine and has been writing for The Progressive, almost pushing a decade now, Ruth?
Yeah.
Pushing a decade. And she's graciously joining us from her home in Madison today. Ruth covers the gamut of political issues in the United States and the world and has written widely about the prospective 2004 presidential race. We'll be getting to that later in the show. But if you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Ruth Conniff, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. And our toll-free number from around the state or the country, 800-222-9455. Our lines are open. Our operators are anxiously awaiting to field your call if you do wish to call in and go on the air with Ruth. So please do pick up the phone and give us a call. Ruth, you know, another story in the New York Times this morning I thought was quite interesting was on the front page, the lead article about the military presence of the U.S. in post-war Iraq. And what was striking about it to me was it was juxtaposed with a good deal of the criticism of the U.S. presence in Iraq, which is highlighted in the same front page this morning in the New York Times by Iraqis. And what was striking was that before the war, I was at a teach-in here on the University of Illinois campus with a very prominent and distinguished professor who said he had spoken to his close friends in the national security establishment and in the White House and was assured the United States had no ambitions to be in Iraq after they got rid of Saddam Hussein. They just wanted to take him out and then depart. And that the idea that there was anything about oil or military control of the region was simply paranoid delusions that really no basis in fact. Yet here we see this morning on the front page of the New York Times, I'm sure you saw it as well, the United States is currently planning to have four permanent bases in Iraq, regardless of whatever government comes into power.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of amazing how dismissive the Bush administration has been of this suggestion that the reason that the United States went into Iraq was to establish a beachhead in the Middle East, essentially to place our troops there to get control of a region that is both unstable and there is some, you know, legitimate concern about a threat of terrorism to the United States from there, but it's also just a very, very wealthy region. I think it was Molly Ivins who said back during the Gulf War that we wouldn't have been defending Kuwait from Iraq's invasion if it were the eggplant capital of the world. I mean, it's, you know, clearly that the fact that it's such an oil-rich region is extremely important. And you look at the military contracts that are being handed out and the contracts for rebuilding Iraq, you know, to cronies of the Bush administration. This is the kind of stuff that you would like to hear the Democrats talking about a bit more.
Yeah, let's talk about the Democrats in a second. But first, let's go to the phone lines. We have lines open still. The number is 333-9455. I'm Bob McChesney. Our guest today on Media Matters is Ruth Conniff. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one. Champagne, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Yeah, thank you. This goes to the press coverage and perhaps the preparation for the next war's press coverage. Take note that even though they had asked from Al Jazeera and other press agencies that were in Baghdad for their global positioning coordinates and had received it, as well as the Palestine Hotel, which everybody knew where it was, and you know, in these tanks, they've got all this information at their fingertips. It seems that the Pentagon decided to fire a warning shot at the heads of the unembedded reporters and then basically told them, you know, you shouldn't be there. You know, you got to take your risk, and we're going to shoot you if you're not there under our auspices.
Yeah, there's a column in The Nation by Alexander Coburn specifically on this topic in this latest issue talking about the, the attacks on reporters, the dead reporters in Iraq, and particularly that attack on the Palestine Hotel. I don't know about the deliberate targeting of the Al Jazeera office or the reporters who died there, but it is striking, Coburn points out, the odds, 1,000 journalists in Iraq and 10 dead, about 200,000 U.S.-UK soldiers and maybe 125 dead. In other words, there was a greater per capita loss to reporters than there was to soldiers in this war.
Okay, the lines are still open if you'd like to call in. Yeah, Ruth, let's go back to the Democrats here that you were talking to before that caller. What's going on with the Democratic Party?
Well, the Democratic Party is sort of struggling, continuing its struggle to find an effective opposition to Bush. And there is really a struggle that's been going on for some years now for the soul of the Democratic Party between the Democratic Leadership Council on the one hand, which continues even today to advise candidates not to oppose Bush on the war or on foreign policy and to sort of target in Clinton-esque manner sort of minor social policy critiques, minor tweaks that they would make on domestic issues, but the importance of projecting a very aggressive, very pro-military image. They continue to advise that. And then on the other hand, there are...
Ruth, before you go on, let's just, for the sake of some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, as it's called, maybe just a little bit of background. When did these guys come along? What's their purpose, and how effective have they been?
The Democratic Leadership Council was founded in the early 80s, and one of its illustrious leaders was Bill Clinton. And Clinton and Gore helped devise the Democratic Leadership Council strategy, which was to really go after the white Southern vote and to argue that the Democratic Party had drifted too far to the left and needed to return to the center. And really, they came up with a strategy of co-opting Republican issues. They were very hard on welfare. They were very pro-military, and they sort of eschewed the traditional down-at-the-heel constituents of the Democratic Party. There were some veiled racially divisive messages that came out, you remember, in the early Clinton campaign, the Sister Soldier incident. There was just an effort to court this angry white male vote. Today, the Democratic Leadership Council is talking about, there have always been these sort of chimerical figures that they come up with in their focus groups. There were the soccer moms, now they're what they call the office park dads. They continue to look at the electorate and to slice more and more thinly the suburban white voters who turn out in greater numbers, as many traditional Democratic constituents vote in smaller and smaller numbers. So as the, African-American vote drifts away, as the labor constituency, as activists and people who care passionately about what have been at one time traditional Democratic issues, diminish. They focus very much on taking these votes or fighting for these votes with Republicans of the you know, the white suburban voters, and particularly voters in the South.
And who are the current politicians who are sort of you'd identify with the DLC approach?
Bill Lieberman, certainly, Martin Frost, you know, the centrist Democrats, the ones that you hear not opposing the Bush administration in any aggressive way. Al Gore, the charter member of the DLC.
And who do they oppose in the party? Who are their opponents?
Well, they're quite snide about anyone on the left end of the political spectrum. So, you know, the two leftmost candidates, the leftmost candidate is Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio, and they are quite snide, and in fact produced a letter recently that derided Kucinich as sort of a pathetic figure who championed all the old and outdated ideas of the left. And they deride Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, who's really become known as the anti-war candidate and is known as a liberal. Although it's interesting, I interviewed Dean, and he does not call himself a liberal. And, you know, back in Vermont was viewed as something of a centrist, but he is nationally perceived as being one of the most liberal candidates.
Well, I want to get on with this discussion a lot more because I know you've written, just in the recent Progressive, you have an article on Kucinich, and you've written about Dean, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about this. Well, let's go back to the phone lines. If you want to call in and speak with our guest today on Media Matters, this is Ruth Conniff, the political editor of the Progressive. The number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Dixon, Illinois, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Yes, an honor.
Well, it's an honor to have you.
Quick comment and a question. My comment, they keep talking about this being a war for oil and all that, or even a war for political power. It seems to me that really the country, particularly the leadership, is in the middle of an existentialist crisis. They want power. They're looking for meaning. Now that the Cold War is over, it's like, what are we going to do? And I really think that bears some exploring. My question, though, is, I don't know, we seem to have this attitude going back a few centuries, you know, of to the victor go the spoils, that we're handing out contracts and we're handing out governments. And it's like, it's almost ironic to ask who died and left us in charge. But that's almost, you know, it's like, where do we get the authority for any of this? And is there any power in the world that can counter it?
That's a great question.
Yeah. It is. I mean, the brazenness of this administration is really breathtaking. In locking the UN out of this process, both at the beginning in terms of, you know, creating a genuine coalition instead of, you know, the euphemistic coalition that was essentially just the United States and to some degree Britain, and then now in the wake of the war, making it clear that the Bush administration really is not going to rely on the United Nations to help rebuild Iraq or to oversee the interim government, the military occupation. You know, just from a PR perspective, the images of the U.S. flags going up in the place of statues of Saddam Hussein and the, you know, appointment of Jay Gardner in a secret, undemocratic process to lead, to be the MacArthur, essentially, of Iraq and to lead this military occupation, it's just such a... seems like such hubris.
You know,
so brazen.
You know, Ruth, what's striking to me is that, you know, growing up as I did in the 60s and the early 70s, the United States was involved in Vietnam, and anti-war critics oftentimes called it an imperial country with all these adventures around the world and military conflicts and bases. And the United States was often accused of that by its enemies, especially the Soviet Union and China at that time being an imperialist power. And intellectuals in this country, the leaders of our government, all recoiled at that charge, repudiated it, said that's absolutely not true. The last thing the United States wants to do is be the global emperor. It's simply advocating the interests of democracy and human rights around the world and protecting those from other empires that are on the loose. What's striking now, it seems to be, is that there is almost, not almost, there is in fact a frank confession that by those who run in the country that, yes, we are an empire. It is our world, and we have to be willing to do what it takes to run it.
Yeah, it's a matter of raw power, and I think this war, the way in which it was begun unilaterally and without any international consensus or international cooperation was a real break from specifically from international law, from the UN Charter, and just from a sort of a, as you say, sort of a sense of decency and the idea that the rule of law is what matters, that we don't want to have, you know, a world in which just because a country is strong, it's able to claim resources and push other countries around. And, you know, I mean, this is, there are clearly people within the Bush administration who have been advocating this very aggressive, what they call forward-leaning approach for a long time. And unfortunately, at the moment anyway, it looks like the people in the administration, particularly Donald Rumsfeld, who are very big advocates of this, of aggression, are on top, because this war was pretty quick, and they're able to claim success and to, you know, by keeping a fairly low troop commitment to flex their muscle to begin to threaten Syria and Iran, that basically the United States is militarily so strong and so aggressive that it is prepared to wage war without provocation and call the shots in the region. So I think it's true. I think there is kind of a nakedness to this aggressive stance that is, you know, I sort of feel like it's a failure of imagination in a way for those of us on the left who didn't really see that coming. I mean, there were a lot of right-wing policy think tanks that had devised these kinds of scenarios. You know, this stuff didn't get cooked up, you know, just since Bush was elected. But this kind of aggression, this foreign policy, particularly in the wake of 9/11, I think that helped make it possible, the idea that we are very unsafe, playing on the insecurity of Americans, the sense that we're threatened. It's sort of, you know, turning us into the Israelis in a way, that we're, you know, we're going to live in fear of terrorism. We're going to pursue this very aggressive policy. We're going to, you know, be guided by fear. And it just, it seems like a long march into a really dark future, unless we can do something to change our government and its policies.
We're talking to Ruth Conniff, who you've just been listening to today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple lines, well, actually have one line open if you want to call in. We're going to go right back to the phones now. The number is 333-9455, the toll-free number, which is open, 800-222-9455. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Line two?
That's you.
Hi.
Congratulations.
I appreciate your views. Would you please comment on right-wing radio talk show hosts? Limbaugh, we understand, but now there's Hannity and some very abrasive woman on WLS Chicago. Do those people really believe what they're saying, or is it a gimmick for entertainment?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Because, you know, I used to work for Fox News, which is Sean Hannity's employer, one of his employers, and I remember talking to Roger Ailes, who has been so successful in building up this Fox News empire, about, you know, what is TV all about, and he was really driving home the idea that it is entertainment, that's what it is. And I think, you know, do they really believe it? I mean, clearly they're comfortable with their positions. There's a whole right-wing kind of outrageous entertainment style, though, that is, you know, Sean Hannity is one example. I'm in a blank on the name of the woman, Ann Coulter.
You're permitted to blank on that name.
Is another example. You know, people who get a lot of mileage out of being really, really outrageous. I mean, Ann Coulter saying that the United States should march into all of the Muslim countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. You know, it's just this kind of in-your-face style, and it's almost a comedic style. I mean, it's just a really...
You know, you're talking about TV, Ruth, but I think the caller also talked about initially radio, where in many respects it's even a more pervasive phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I don't know about Madison today, but I know it seems like in almost every city in the country now there's sort of a local Limbaugh.
Yep.
Or several of them, and they almost all are dedicated to the idea of making Rush Limbaugh look like a liberal by comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there's been a lot of just sort of earnest discussion of this on the left, a lot of people rubbing their chins. How do we, you know, develop a left-wing Rush Limbaugh? How do we recapture this kind of populist energy, because there's no question that they're onto something. I mean, there are many, many listeners who love just that brazen, opinionated, brash, in-your-face style. And there are a few, it used to be actually that the left had more of a lock on that, that sense of being the underdog, of making fun of people in power, of, you know, speaking out for the little guy. And somehow, you know, sort of ironically, the right seems to have been able to capture that role. And it isn't really rightfully theirs because, of course, you know, political conservatives represent entrenched power. They represent, you know, big money. They don't represent a subversive underdog point of view.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ruth Conniff today in Media Matters. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Please join us on Easter Sunday. Let's go back to the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Hi, so for line one?
You're line one. Congratulations.
Well, where to start? It's just very hard to say. But since the title of the show is Media Matters, I'd just like to comment on what I perceive as the media take on the war and what I think about it. I have been breathtakingly amazed at how well the media has covered this war. I had expected far more obnoxious comments from the left, and even from the mainstream bastions of the left, such as National Public Radio itself in Washington, I've been pleasantly surprised that they have been somewhat subdued in their criticism of the United States. They have made some terrible gaffes early in the war, claiming how badly it was going, when in fact it was going breathtakingly well. But on the whole, very few shows on the national media have been really awful. There have been there are exceptions in the local scale, for example. Where it has been and is, for example, during this show, extremely and stridently left-wing. After all, the Progressive is, practically speaking, a communist organization. And you have mentioned other far left-wing things. But basically,
like
I've been
the Democratic
amazed.
Party, yeah.
And what I was bothered by, though, was the both the CNN admission and the reaction to it, that they had been kowtowing to the Iraqi line in order simply to maintain a presence in Baghdad, and not giving telling people that. I mean, I have noticed on all the reports from the field in our embedded reporters that they always contain disclaimers that basically say we may be lying. But yet, when CNN reported from Baghdad on all of these things, when they clearly were lying, and the head of CNN News in Baghdad has admitted they were lying, they didn't say, there were no disclaimers. They just gave the stories. Why does the left not put the disclaimer saying that we know we're lying? And it just goes on and on and on. I can tell you, though, why the non-left-wing press, such as Hannity and O'Reilly and all of these people, it's because it's becoming mainstream. The left wing had taken over the press for many years, and when 9/11 happened, that basically stopped. And
9/11 is a little late in the cycle. I mean, Fox News has really been taking over the market from CNN for quite a while before September 11th.
But it didn't spill over into CNN until 9/11, and I think that is the big news media story. I think your perception as a far left wing person is based on a far left wing which is far out of sync with reality. Even here in Champaign-Urbana, if you talk to the people that aren't in the, you know, nattering nabobs of negativism inside the university, you find a Fox News perspective.
Well, I'll tell you what, caller. Let's let Ruth respond to all of your comments now.
I think that's enough because I have so much more to say, but I think I'll just restrict myself to the actual media comment.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and your media comment is essentially that CNN admitted it was lying.
Ruth, are you there?
Yeah,
go ahead.
That CNN admitted it was lying when it participated in press conferences held by the Iraqi information minister in Baghdad.
The caller,
they asked softball questions. I think they did say they asked softball questions.
I think also the report was that journalists, not just the CNN, but most of the U.S. journalists based in Iraq conceded that they felt uncomfortable exposing the horrors of Saddam Hussein's regime because it would jeopardize their ability to remain in the country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, and on the other hand, the embedded reporters followed all kinds of military rules and restricted their coverage, with the exception of Geraldo Rivera from Fox News. You know, followed the rules and did what the military told them to do in their reports. I think the caller is basically, you know, there's this sort of struggle for the ideological middle ground. You know, everybody claims that they represent the objective, sensible point of view and that other people are extremists. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of that flying around. And, I mean, especially now, it's kind of tiresome to hear the progressive magazine called communist and sort of this assertion that, that it's a liberal media, when so clearly, I mean, NPR, which is one example that he used, is running scared. I mean, they did really, I thought, pretty pathetic coverage of the war, including, you know, with a few bright spots. They did some reports that were clearly designed to make sure that they were not perceived as liberal, and that's because Newt Gingrich and other congressional Republicans have successfully launched a years-long campaign to try to defund NPR and to constantly threaten them with having their funding yanked because they are, according to these far right-wingers, left-leaning. So, you know, the media wars, you know, and this whole war over what's fair and balanced, I mean, there's this brazen presentation of right-wing media like Fox News as fair and balanced when clearly it's not. It's very... just a very strong right-wing bias on the one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have sort of institutional, you know, fairly mainstream centrist outlets like NPR and the New York Times, which, and the caller quoted William Safire talking about the nattering nabobs of negativism. Ever since the Vietnam era, since the Nixon administration, right-wingers have accused the mainstream media of having a liberal bias. And it just, it becomes a thinner and thinner accusation.
You know, Ruth, one question, an assumption the caller had, I think it's an important one, is that lack of support or criticism of the administration's foreign policy or the war is anti-Americanism. I mean, and if that, do you think that's true? Because that seems to be a foundation of the critique.
Well, obviously, I don't think it's true. You know, I mean, I am left-wing, and I mean, the progressive is quite upfront about its politics, which are not communist, but certainly left-wing. Civil libertarian politics. And I obviously believe that it's important to have a lot of voices and an independent media, which is, I mean, this is what, you know, we're supposedly defending this great value of freedom in our country, and including the freedom of political dissent, which is perhaps the most important political freedom that you can have. So, you know, it's sad that people, I think, internalize these ideas that are pumped out by the White House that, you know, to dissent or to not be supportive of administration policy is not to be a true American. The Bush administration doesn't have a lock on Americanism. I mean, here's a guy who, you know, barely managed to get into office. You know, there's a whole vast country out there that is adamantly opposed to his policies, and it's very important that we maintain a healthy democracy in which we can talk about that and say that and are not, you know, as under the Saddam Hussein regime, forced to kowtow to our leaders and pretend, you know, a kind of mind lock that we just, you know, believe what we're told to believe.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ruth Conniff today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number is 333-9455. Ruth's the political editor for The Progressive magazine, alternately described as left-wing or on the far radical left fringe, depending on your taste. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line three, you're on with Ruth Conniff.
We were talking earlier about hubris and, you know, whether the, you know, people like Rumsfeld or our administration is acting with, you know, is shocking and awe-inspiring in its hubris. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any other power to counterbalance or the U.S., and that we're making the law, and the law means we, you know, whatever we want to say the law is, because we have the power, which seems to be, you know, kind of world totalitarianism that we're heading towards. you know, whether you're inside the United States and you, you know, you're for civil liberties, that seems to be becoming a more and more dangerous position to take if you worry about any kind of threats that someone might make to your freedom and welfare. How is the world going to react to all this, whether it be the French, the Germans, the Europeans? I mean, it just seems like it's just setting us up for, you know, terror and chaos. If there cannot be any kind of just rule of law, how will people respond?
Well, I think that's right. The Europeans are the place the place to look for some counterbalance to U.S. power, because together the European Union represents, you know, a powerful, organized, wealthy group that can, in fact, you know, if it works together and if it figures out what its sort of united front would be, can work as some kind of counterweight to the U.S. And the U.S. is required to go through the U.N., you know, continues to be required to go through the U.N. to figure out this transitional government in Iraq. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, we flouted international law in waging this war, and the administration seems to be pretty brazen about saying that it's going to call the shots, that there will be some role for the U.N., but clearly not a major one, that it's going to hand out these contracts. But I think right now what's going on is that the European Union is sort of scrambling to figure out how it can effectively operate in the world today and how to react to the United States and whether to go along with a lot of U.S. policy, whether to not allow itself to be arm-twisted into that and to oppose this increasing U.S. presence in the Middle East and sort of, you know, what the administration is using the term "facts on the ground" to describe, as you know, this is a term used by the Sharon government to talk about building settlements in the occupied territories in Palestine. Here we are, you know, moving in, creating these military bases, awarding these contracts, and essentially creating a fact of a U.S.-led government there. But there is still international law, and there is still a European Union, and you know, one hopes that there will be some check on U.S. power and some debate and some sense of civilized and legal proceeding.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. We've got Ruth Conniff, our guest, the political editor of the Progressive Magazine, joining us today in Media Matters. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Yeah, your guest said that England wasn't fully behind us in this war, and I think that's exactly right. I got a hold of the Evening Standard recently, and they were showing that one of the hot sellers in women's apparel was panties with the inscription, "The only bush I trust is my own." I thought you might appreciate that.
Hey, this is family radio, man.
It was a family sentiment.
Okay.
And the question that I've got, though, is I thought it was kind of strange. I haven't read it yet, but I read the New York Times online, and it says they've got a couple stories where the Washington Post, too, saying that Rumsfeld is stronger than ever. And I'm wondering how that could happen. I thought for sure the whole deal with the Ministry of Oil and letting the museum get raided would really, you know, cause some problems. But apparently I'm wrong, and I'll hang up and listen to your guest. Thank you.
Yeah, what is it, Ruth? Is it a Teflon that goes on this administration with what's happened since the end of the war? I mean, that far from the heroic liberation of Iraq, we have massive demonstrations by Iraqis against both Saddam and the United States. We've seen the destruction of the great treasures, the theft of the great treasures of Iraq without any U.S. Opposition or police effort to prevent that from taking place. Yet, as this caller said, Donald Rumsfeld this morning is being lionized as this sort of great giant Alexander the Great of the 21st century.
Well, I mean, Rumsfeld just lived through, I mean, if you look at sort of what the whole story is here, I mean, he lived through a moment of real crisis, and Seymour Hersh was reporting a lot on the dissent in the Pentagon, the real distaste for Rumsfeld among generals in the Pentagon, who felt that he undermanned the war effort, and that it was going to be a real quagmire, that in fact they were not going to be able to march into Baghdad, that this thing was going to go on for a lot longer than people expected, that there were going to be heavy casualties among the ground forces who were not going to have sufficient backup, et cetera. So, I mean, he actually is vindicated in his approach of not committing.
The strategic approach.
That's right, the force size that the Pentagon brass wanted. So in that, you know, and what he's done with that is to announce this paradigm shift in U.S. policy, which is to be able to make a relatively low commitment militarily, win a war, and thus threaten the ability to fight another simultaneous war. Really just, it's part of this aggressive political posture, which is to say we're ready to take on all comers.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you know, he has been vindicated. You know, in terms of what's happening in Iraq with the occupation is just beginning. And I think Americans have, you know, a short attention span in terms of, you know, is this really going to be, you know, the liberated democratic Iraq that they've projected? Or, you know, is it going to be a disaster for the Iraqi people? I think more, you know, to the point in terms of public opinion here in this country, is this going to be a really long occupation with a lot of suicide bombings at checkpoints and sort of a sense of not being able to get out of there? Was it going to turn into kind of a Somalia situation or Lebanon? Or, you know, is it going to be something that the U.S. can kind of forget about the way that we have about Afghanistan, which also has degenerated since we were there? But, you know, you don't hear people discuss that as a failure because the U.S. is not there anymore, and it's not, you know, we're not taking casualties there.
Yeah, we're talking to Ruth Conniff today, our guest on Media Matters. I've got a couple callers. Before I turn to those callers, though, I'd just like to let you know, listeners, that if you want to get a weekly update on who our guests are going to be, links to their articles or their books if they have them, and who's coming up and who's been on the show, we offer that as a service. Actually, several hundred listeners now take advantage of it. If you're interested in getting such a weekly update, please just send an email to our producer, Ben Scott, at dbscott@uiuc.edu, to say, sign me up for the Media Matters weekly email, and you will get it, dbscott@uiuc.edu. And at any time, if you want to get off the list, just email Ben again, and he'll take you right off. It's no problem. You get no commercial messages, no advertising, no nothing like that. So just if you want to get on our mailing list, lots of people use it, please email Ben Scott at dbscott@uiuc.edu. Our upcoming shows, we're going to be featuring Jenny Toomey, the head of the Future of Music Coalition, Dean Baker, one of the leading economists who studied the media and media concentration issues and media policy, Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation magazine, and we're going to have Ruth Conniff's boss in a couple weeks, Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive magazine. So let's go back to the phone lines now. Champaign County, line one, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I'm sort of stumbling on the same thing that the last caller was talking about, though I don't have a joke, but the whole idea that Rumsfeld is so exalted is just abysmal to me. It's this whole old Europe, there's some people say I was calculated, and I just thought, you know, this was an offhand remark that was absolutely stupid, and I can't imagine that it actually was calculated, but then I guess the Crusader line was actually a calculated line. But actually, I wanted a specific. You're based in Washington, right? So you see.
I used to be based in Washington. I'm actually back in Madison. Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. Well, I heard a Linda Miller from PR Watch talk about the Office of White House Communications, and there apparently is a woman, Tanya, someone or other, who is now with the White House Communications, but she came from Hill & Knowlton, Washington office. So. Mm-hmm. It's quite plausible that she could have been the person that coached, you know, the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador at the time of the first Gulf War, and now she's working her wiles in the Office of Communications. I just, you know, maybe they are wily, but it seems to me that it's more the fact that the press is just so servile that they get away with all of this. It is Teflon. I don't know. I'm sort of just spouting, but I don't know if you know the specifics of this. This person from Hill & Knowlton.
I don't know her background, but I do commend PR Watch to all of your listeners because they are a great organization, and they've done. John Stauber, who runs that outfit, wrote a book called "Toxic Sludge Is Good for You," and talks about just the incredible just the really astounding, brazen PR efforts by some of these big PR firms. And he's constantly uncovering more interesting dirt of that type. So, yeah, I think they have a website, actually.
Right, prwatch.org. But then the later book is Trust Me, I'm an Expert or something like that.
Yeah.
But the whole point is that there, you know, it seems like somebody somewhere might, in the regular media, might point out the kind of, you know, they do laudatory stories on how well they're spinning, I guess, but they don't do anything that seems to be critical of, I guess they don't want to jeopardize their, you know, their White House seat or their
well,
their
I mean, you know, some of this information is out there, and I think it's, you know, how many people know what Hill and Knowlton is, you know, how many people know, you know, sort of who their unsavory clients are, and, you know, I mean, the question is raised, you know, how much does this information really matter? I mean, Richard Perle's unsavory clients, Henry Kissinger's unsavory clients have certainly been well publicized, but does it make a big difference? You know, it doesn't seem to slow down the administration. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess that stuff is important if somebody is getting a big appointment. You know, there are certain moments when individuals have been forced to resign from boards or you know, in Kissinger's case, not take, you know, a position with Homeland Security because of, you know, these grotesque conflicts of interest. But then on the other hand, you know, we have Jay Gardner now who's going to be running this interim administration in Iraq, who's himself a weapons contractor with connections to companies, still the president of a weapons contracting firm with direct financial interests in major contracts rebuilding Iraq. So I think it's really important that this stuff get out there. You know, that information is available. And I think it's important to spread the word.
You know, Ruth, how much of it, in defense of journalists who are covering this story, how much of this, the problem they face is that since there aren't necessarily leading Democrats pushing this story, sort of pushing the issue, that for journalists to go out and start asking these tough questions exposes them as sort of being partisan. But if they're reporting on leading Democrats making this case, then they're just reporting, you know, the news. And since no Democrats or few of the leaders are really pushing these stories aggressively, it's harder for journalists then to push it.
Well, I think there's a kind of an institutional code in Washington about, you know, you just don't, there's certain kinds of attacks on people that just aren't made. And, you know, I'm thinking of Dennis Kucinich, who was on Meet the Press. And, you know, he's been given a hard time, not just by the Democratic Leadership Council, other Democrats, but also in the media, as just not being considered a viable candidate. And that, you know, you get into this sort of circular problem when you're not considered a viable candidate and then can't raise as much funding, and then you know, there's just sort of like being declared not viable from the beginning.
You don't get the coverage, so no one hears about you, so you can't become viable.
Well, but there's a definite outsider status. I mean, Kucinich went on Meet the Press, and he said that this is a war about oil, which is, you know, not said in official Washington. You know, he made many of these very sharp critiques. And it just culturally, that sets him apart from other Democratic candidates. And it causes a lot of discomfort and eyebrow raising, even in the so-called liberal media. I mean, in the Washington Post, after he appeared, there's a column criticizing him, criticizing actually Meet the Press and Tim Russert for even having him on because they considered him such a, you know, a wacko outsider. And I think that kind of official condemnation, you know, the fact that people in Washington, especially, you know, people in an administration who've been around for a while, they've been, you know, in previous administrations and they've been in you know, through the revolving door to work for lobbying firms, you know, there is that trail, the fact that they've, you know, gotten money from interest groups and then they've gotten back into public life, it's really considered impolite to bring that sort of thing up. And,
you know, Ruth Conniff, can I ask you something? You've been writing about Dennis Kucinich. You've mentioned him a few times now. He is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives now for a few terms from Cleveland, Ohio, the most strongly identified anti-war, anti-militarist member probably of the U.S. Congress, or certainly on the short list of any group, and very progressive on a number of economic and social issues as well. He's running for president now. He's one of a field of 7, 8, 9 Democrats. He's already been cast as having no hope whatsoever. You've interviewed him. You've talked to him. You know a bit about him. Are his views simply make him unnominatable by the Democratic Party, in your view?
Do his views make him unnominatable?
Does he have a viable chance, do you think?
You know, I hate to say that he doesn't have a viable chance. he is a way left-wing candidate. I think that he could really stir up some interest and excitement in the primaries. I think he could force some other candidates to take on some issues and to speak to a base that's just desperate for a strong opposition to this administration and to pick on the many, many things that can be picked on in the Bush administration. But, you know, Dennis's personal style and his idealism definitely make him outside the mainstream of presidential candidates. So, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, I mean, he's running as a very dark horse.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to our final caller, who's been extremely patient. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
People are kind of getting around to the point that I think, after listening to the whole program, seems to be need to be made, is that things are happening now in our country because we made certain political decisions 2 years ago, and that if people want to change what happens in our country, they need to start now to, shore up, if necessary, the Democratic Party, which is essentially a two-party country, is really our most viable option. It's obviously true that untrue what was said in the last election, which was that it didn't make any difference who we elected. It did make a difference who we elected. I think some of these things would simply not have been happening if we had gritted our teeth and elected a less than perfect Democratic candidate. I would hope that, I know I have always considered myself a liberal. I know that I now see clearly what I need to do, which is to get out there and start being a political person and start working through it. Through what is appearing to me my only viable alternative right now, which is the Democratic Party.
Caller, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I hear the band tuning up. We've only got about a little less than a minute, so let's let Ruth Conniff respond, because I know that the progressive, Ruth, actually not officially but unofficially supported Nader, certainly sympathetic to the Nader run in 2000.
Okay.
Do you and the people at the progressive, do you think your fellow progressives regret that at this point?
You know, I think that the caller raises a really important point, and I think that it would be foolish to dismiss the idea that the Bush administration is far worse than a lot of people who voted for Nader could have envisioned. And that's sort of what I was alluding to when I said I thought it was a failure of imagination. So I think that there is some serious rethinking to be done. However, what if it's Joe Lieberman? You know,
yeah.
What if the Democrats put up Joe Lieberman as our candidate?
Well, on that note, and that's a somber note, we're going to have to bid you farewell. Ruth Conniff, the political editor of the Progressive Magazine, thank you very much for being our guest this hour. It's really been wonderful having you.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Hope all goes well. Join us in 167 hours for our next episode of Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to thank Ben Scott and Andrew Boyle for doing the production this week. Thank you. Goodbye.